I first visited the Media Lab up at MIT back in the 1980s, when it was a one-of-a-kind crucible for great ideas, for young students, and the power of thinking about technology without limits. In the 25 years since, I even spent some time there seeing firsthand how the place turned academics into real innovation. E-book readers, robots, unique insights into the brain and autism, advanced prosthetics to make humans part machine. Today, there are many innovation centers around the world, many modeled after the Media Lab, but the urgency for reinventing the ways in which true innovation can happen has never been greater. Frank Moss was the director of the MIT Media Lab from 2005 through 2010, and he tells the story of some of those wild inventor innovators in his new book, The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices. He stopped by the studio yesterday to call on the next generation of innovators to believe in the magic of those original sorcerers.
The unique thing about the Media Lab is it's one place in the world where students, the faculty, even the corporate sponsors who show up from the big companies can dream and can invent and create according to their passions and their curiosities, not dictated by a research plan. They're really just saying, what am I passionate about? Let's explore that and see where it goes.
You know, the amazing thing from my experience being at the lab, when there are these big events, when the sponsors come in, you know, unlike, say, the TED conference where it's big shots, or at an Apple Macworld conference where everyone wants to see Steve Jobs, at the lab it's, what do the students have? And these nobodies get up with this amazing set of ideas and completely amaze the crowd.
It's really what attracted me to the lab. The first time I came to the lab when I was interviewing, I came across a student named Adam Boulanger, a fellow who you have
Absolutely,
come across
sure.
as well. And Adam, kind of a typical, he's a musician, computer scientist, and he was tinkering with something in Todd Machover's lab. And I walked up, and all of a sudden, Adam started to just tell me what he was doing. And I think I was so impressed by the passion and the articulate nature of this technologist. That's unusual.
I mean, and what he was doing was creating this language, this interface that allowed people without communications skills to use technology to basically express through music and other means, you know, what was going on inside of them.
He was wearing a headband, and on that headband was a little infrared tracker, and he was practicing moving that tracker across the screen to actually compose notes and music and then, you know, whole compositions. And he was practicing with that because he was preparing it for a fellow named Dan Elsey at the Tewksbury State Hospital, who he was working with, a fellow
Profound
with cerebral palsy.
Cerebral palsy, right, exactly. You know, it seems to me that one of the real successes at the lab and the successes of innovation in general in high technology is discovering what technology says about us as much as it's figuring out something that's on a piece of silicon or in some inanimate object.
Well, you know, that's what the Media Lab was all about from the very beginning. And, you know, its major goal is to find things that bring out in us our ability to express, our ability to communicate in ways we couldn't before.
And also to expect surprises. Deb Roy, who began by using high-speed computers to figure out how his kid learned to talk, that morphed into five different kinds of things just in the course of his research at the lab.
It's a process I call serendipity by design in the book. It's about giving these students and faculty the ability to create an event according to their passion, but then to follow it through a series of events, many of which might be coincidental or just directions that were completely unanticipated. And it's in following those things from one to another where the great innovations come. In the case of Deb, he began with a big, powerful system to understand how his child learns language. It progressed from there to a bank that's a sponsor of the Media Lab using the same technology to understand the emotions that its tellers are conveying to its customers, all the way to fantasy baseball and ultimately to tools for marketing.
But what he really discovered was the power of huge amounts of data and being able to search it and use it. In a way, it was something about the scale of the data that really changed the way now we all look at data sets.
Well, each and every one of us is becoming our own cloud of data. Our footprints or fingerprints on the web, our cell phone or our smartphone measures who we are, where we are, when we're there, ultimately even your vital signs. That's a huge database, and the ability to mine that database can tell us a lot about ourselves and actually enable us to take control of our lives in ways we couldn't possibly have before.
And with the machines as an assist, you also described the story about a student who actually creates a personal trainer that's not the most sophisticated robot in the world, but it has a very sophisticated understanding about what humans need.
You know, not only what humans need, but what signals the humans are giving us. You know, most of our communication actually occurs nonverbally. And this robot that Corey Kidd produced actually does that and actually also interfaces with the dieter in a way that convinces them to stick to their diet. So there's nonverbal communication that goes on, and understanding at a depth what people are all about is where technology is really going in the future.
So what are the institutions that are going to mobilize the young minds, the minds that are out there listening to this program right now who want to get involved, but maybe don't necessarily see, you know, President Obama and his Sputnik moments or you know, the Steve Jobses of the world as necessarily a door in?
Well, I think it's going to come through rethinking education as a system of learning. You know, today we try and teach people. And one of the fundamental principles of the Media Lab is that education really happens better through learning. And learning also happens through doing. And so one of the fundamental principles that I call hard fun in the book is by actually going and building things, whether it's building a digital media program or building an actual gizmo. It's all about getting back to building and doing physical things. And it's the building that you learn, you fail, you retry. And that whole process of actually putting hands on, that's where young people have to go today.
You know, you've had a long career at the lab, at IBM, which, of course, was once a huge sort of source of innovation. So who does it best? Who does this innovation thing best? Is it small groups? Is it big institutions? Is it corporations? Is it, you know, offices in the basement?
Well, it used to work very well as kind of an ecosystem because the government, you know, funded research in universities and university researchers did really gutsy things, and the industry took that and productized it. But that whole synergy between industry and academia and government is now gone. And so I would say that it only works best in pockets today. Of course, the Media Lab, in some ways, is the ultimate place in which this occurs. But I've seen it occur very well in elementary schools, where forward-thinking teachers understand that computers are more than just about connecting and more about searching for information, and they're using them as tools of expression. If we're going to survive and not only survive but thrive in the 21st century, we have to get this level of creativity right down to the individual.
And so Media Lab's coming to a second grade classroom possibly near you. That's Frank Moss, former director of the MIT Media Lab and author of the new book, The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices. Thanks so much.
If you're fascinated by technology and robots, you can actually get more of it by reading the first book in our summer book club series. It's a novel called Robopocalypse from roboticist and author Daniel Wilson.
I spent a lot of time building robots and learning about them, and it's hard, you know. And at the end of it, I think you end up with a real respect for robots.
That's Daniel Wilson speaking on our show yesterday. You can learn more about his novel, Robopocalypse. Go to thetakeaway.org and click on blog. He wrote some things there. And share your own summer book club list. Tweet with the hashtag TakeawayReads or call us at 8778-MYTAKE. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.